It has never been more important for digital products to be incredibly simple, beautiful, and unique. I think with AI becoming so prolific in the production of products, it's becoming more and more important for businesses and digital products to find ways to stand out both to their users, but also to the broader world in terms of their brand and their narrative.
Welcome to the Right Place podcast. My name is John, and my guest today is Lee Stefanski. She's a pro in flipping the narrative when it comes to app design and digital products. What does the user want? What experience will get them over the line? And how can we make it a memorable product is what she is all about. It's not just choosing button colors. Lee is the MD of Now Boarding, a Cape Town-based but globally focused UX design agency that represents your users and fits perfectly between business innovation and product development. Lee is also a member of the Lacquer Network like myself and a regular climber of Lion's Head with World's Green Walk. Welcome, Lee. It's great to chat to you today.
Lovely to be here. Thank you so much, John. And wow, what an amazing introduction.
Thanks so much, Lee. You're an amazing individual and it's great to talk to you today. And I want to dive right in, Lee. You say you're the person in the room who represents the user. What are users looking for in 2025?
Sure, John, it's never been a more interesting time to be in digital. I think, you know, if we rewind back to, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago in Now Boarding's history, we've been doing what we do for 15 years. So we've been doing it for longer than what we call product design. The other term for it is UX and UI design. When we started doing it, those terms did not exist. So we started really, we were on the forefront of innovation around crafting experiences that put the user first. And obviously, staying in the game for as long as we have seen so many trends evolve. We have seen users in their sophistication grow and change so much. And, you know, a huge part of what we do is staying on top of those trends. But I think, you know, in this day and age, it has never been more important for digital products to be incredibly simple, beautiful, and unique. I think with AI becoming so prolific in the production of products, it's becoming more and more important for businesses and digital products to find ways to stand out both to their users, but also to the broader world in terms of their brand and their narrative. So what do users want? They want what they've always wanted, which is simplicity, clean, clear, intuitive products, but memorable experiences that they want to keep coming back to.
I think that's definitely the golden thread, because if a product irritates you or an app irritates you, people just abandon it instantly because there is so much choice and there probably is a couple of different versions out there. Some that work faster, some that work slower, some that have more features, some that are more user-focused. So if you can nail that, then you're going to keep users coming back. Because if they're not coming back, well, you're never going to sell anything to them.
Absolutely, John. I always refer to my partner, Phil, in these scenarios. And the reason I do that is because he is the most intolerant user I have ever seen. I so enjoy watching him interact with products and services online and how little patience and tolerance he has for anything going wrong. And the reason for that is because he has choice. He can so quickly abandon ship and find something else that is going to satisfy his needs faster, is going to help him to achieve his goals in a far more enjoyable way. So absolutely, I think, you know, the more sophisticated users become, the less tolerant they become.
No, absolutely, Lee, absolutely. And now, Lee, we've talked a little bit about the users, but what happens when the user's needs actually clash with the client's business goals? How do you navigate that?
Oh, John, I mean, there you kind of have to go back to your fundamentals. So if what you're finding is that the experience and the product that you have designed isn't managing to achieve what we would call product market fit, you've missed the boat somewhere along the way. So normally, you know, unless something has gone pretty badly wrong with your design, if there is a fundamental mismatch between the user's goals and the business's goals, that product is never going to be meaningful for your users. And if it's not meaningful, it's never going to be successful. So a lot of what we do revolves around user research, understanding your target market, your personas, etc., and helping businesses to design an experience that aligns with the user's needs and matching that up to the business's goals. So often clients come to us with quite a commercial mindset, or a what we call falling in love with the solution. So they have come up with this amazing solution in their minds with these commercial goals and targets. And our job then is to really listen to those things and then try to really, really understand the user. And that is through user research, it's through user interviews, but it's also through a large amount of experience in the field of doing what we do. And then going, what is the product that needs to be designed that is going to fundamentally help the user to achieve their goals and what it is they want to achieve by using your product to begin with? And how does that marry to the commercial imperatives? And does that, is that ultimately going to create a meaningful experience? If the answer is no, there's a lot of thinking to do, and that discovery phase just becomes more and more important.
No, 100%. And I think that upfront work can really pay dividends going forward, because oftentimes, I'm sure you're not alone. I mean, IT companies seem to be bombarded by client requests, and a lot of it is lastminute.com. They want it now, they want it yesterday. And there's not a lot of thought put in. And they put a lot of pressure on you to work these miracles, which is actually unfair to the whole process. And then they get something out that doesn't work, and then they blame you. But it's because the homework wasn't done, the thought wasn't put into the whole process. So how do you manage those time constraints as well when people just want to hurry up and get stuff done?
John, there's about 6 months ago, we had a really interesting annual debrief with our team. And we sat in a boardroom with a big whiteboard in front of us. And we said, let's just look at which of the projects that went really well this year, and which are the ones that didn't go so well. You know, maybe the relationship is great, but we found it a bit sticky. So we separated our clients into these two columns, or our projects. And we then took a step back and we said, what was the defining factor that separated these two things? And John, fundamentally, the thing that column A's projects all had in common was this role called product management. So product ownership and product management, it's not something that we do as a team, but it's this really, really, really important role on any product team. Anybody who is going to build a product business needs to have very, very strong product management. And the reason for that is we look at a product team as a bit of a golden triangle. So you've got technical that is representing, as it says on the label, the technical side of the project. You've got design that is representing the user and obviously crafting a beautiful experience. And then you've got business that is sitting on the top of the triangle representing the business requirements. Now, what a product manager does is sits beautifully in the middle and coordinates between these different parties, making sure that everybody's requirements as well as constraints are taken into account, but that everything is sorted into what we would call a product roadmap. And with a very well-structured, thought-through product roadmap that everybody buys into, that's how you create momentum. It prevents what we see a lot of in product, which is whiplashing. So we see, you know, business owners or directors of the project on the client side, just moving around and being dragged around by different feature requests from their clients and their customers. But ultimately, the vision is never really achieved because there isn't that coherent flow through the roadmap. So what is that thing? How do you deal with it? It's by having somebody who is very strong and very experienced running that product roadmap. It means the planning and the thinking is all done up front, and the stakeholders of that triangle, being the user experience design team and the technical teams, know exactly what it is we are working on when it comes down the roadmap. The most disruptive thing to a project and a product's momentum is when the sprint lands with us and we aren't clear on what we're doing yet. So then that's when you start burning time.
No, that's a brilliant answer. And I like that you've embedded an extra layer of protection there and an extra person that just has oversight of the bigger picture and then can pull things together. Because oftentimes, like, one part of the project could be streaks ahead and there's another part of the project that hasn't even got off the ground yet. And then there's this mismatch and then one has to catch up with the other. And that's when things start to go dramatically wrong. Now, Lee, you told me that you drive revenue by making it simple for a user to convert or making it so enjoyable to use the product that they become a paying subscriber. Can you give me an example of a project maybe that you've worked on that achieved that?
Absolutely, John. I think, a really, really great case study that we've always been super proud of. And also because it was such a wonderful project to work on. It had all the magic ingredients. It had a great brand. It had a fantastic product manager who was so clear and who was so focused on building a user-centric way of thinking within the business unit itself. And that had a dramatic impact on the outcome of the project. And the reason that I say that is because there was a lot of compliance involved on the project, but where we as the user experience team who were focused on the user said, guys, too many fields, he went and championed that with compliance. He went and had that discussion and he was like, come on, guys, we can do this together as a team. It didn't just become a shoulder shrug that said, guys, compliance says, so we need to comply. So coming back to the project, so it was a project for SnapScan, which many people listening to this, I'm sure, would know. And it was their merchant onboarding experience. So it was very much in the B2B space. And they came to us with the problem of a merchant onboarding conversion drop-off rate. So from the time of a merchant signing up to become a SnapScan merchant, they would move down the funnel and somewhere where things started to get clunky and long and cumbersome, they bail out. So they had a very low percentage of people who had signed up actually converting into SnapScan merchant users. So what we did is we took a step back, and at the time, we could see that from the sign up on the website to the onboarding to ultimately landing in the dashboard experience, it was an incredibly disjointed experience and an experience that was very instructive. So it was pushing users down a funnel without giving them room to feel like they were empowered and in control of their experience. So we said, how do we make the merchant feel like this is their journey? The first thing that we obviously looked at doing was streamlining that journey from even just from a visual perspective. So how could we make it feel incredibly consistent throughout, but also make it feel like a lovable, highly personalized experience? So we personalized at every touch point to make sure that Saskia, who was setting up the Dogstar online store, just felt like it was completely customized to her. And then obviously we do things like reduce fields as much as possible, but allow people the ability to when, if they don't have the documents on hand that they need to be able to complete that one step, that they can always come back to it later. We break it up into small bite-sized chunks with moments of celebration along the way that makes sure you feel like you're achieving things as you go. And ultimately, you land in the merchant portal, which, if you've got a few last things that you need to sort out before you can transact, you can still complete those tasks right at the end. But now, by the time you've got there, as a merchant, you've invested a lot of energy in getting to that point. So you're invested in finishing the job. So ultimately, that experience end-to-end resulted in a 47% improvement in the conversion rate for the clients. So to this day, you know, they say that it's hands down one of their most valuable assets, because fundamentally it totally shifted the goalposts for them in terms of getting merchants on board.
No, that's excellent. I love that example. And I also think, I mean, oftentimes I've filled out stuff or want to subscribe to something, and then you start the process and things will go well. And then suddenly there's this other page and they're asking for this information or that. And like, but this has got nothing to do with why I'm want to buy your product. You don't need this information. This is irrelevant. And then you're frustrated. Then it gets to the next one. Then they want this. And then it starts lagging. And then you're like, oh, this is just rubbish. This is just rubbish. I'm not interested anymore. Let me find something else. And I mean, you've got to almost anticipate these moments. But I think it also comes with experience that what is the least amount of information that we need to capture to get this person over the line into the funnel or into the sales process? Because oftentimes we're trying to get all of the information at the same time, and you just don't need that in order to make a sale sometimes.
Absolutely, John. And I think one of the other traps that we fall into as digital businesses is when we allow the tech stack to dictate the rules on the user side. So that's where silly things from a user experience perspective happen, like asking a user for their physical address twice. And you do that because during one piece of the onboarding, it's asked, maybe let's say for FICA compliance. And then during your checkout, it's asked again, because now there are two different pieces of tech that are being used in that. So, you know, those are things that we work very closely with technical teams on, is we go, let's work together to refine this into a journey that prioritizes the user at the end of the day. But it's about seeing those things and being able to make it as smooth and seamless as possible.
Awesome, Lee. Now, Lee, you've done quite a bit of work in the med tech space. And in that space, there's a lot at stake. How do you approach design when the consequences are life-altering or sometimes unknown?
Oh, John, I mean, you know, that's taking what we do to the most extreme level. You know, we look at the med tech space as such an enormous responsibility. So again, to illustrate with an example, we worked on a project called AI Diagnostics. And AI Diagnostics is absolutely remarkable. It is a digital stethoscope connected to an interface. And what that digital stethoscope is doing is it has got an AI model that is listening to what TB sounds like. And by understanding the sound of TB, it is improving the speed and accuracy of tuberculosis screening. So when that project came to us, we needed to bring empathy to the table to a stronger degree than we have on any other project before. Empathy is always critical. Putting yourself in the user's shoes is always critical. But in a project like this, imagining a nurse who has got an incredibly emotional patient sitting in front of them. This patient might be scared. This patient might not speak the same language as the nurse. There are all sorts of nuances and intricacies that mean the nurse needs to be focused completely on the patient, not on driving the technology and the tools that she is using to do her job. So we really needed to look at that interface and go, how do we make this as clean and intuitive as possible for the nurse so that she barely even needs to think about the fact that she is using it? And that is really one of the key things in an industry like medtech, where the medical practitioner has to be focused on what's happening right in front of them. It could be an absolute life or death scenario where the practitioner needs to quickly be able to glance at their tech and tools to be able to get the insights that help them make a decision in that critical moment. And user experience design is the thing that really makes that information immediately accessible in the way and in the moment that it needs to be accessed. So how do we treat those scenarios, John, with the most extreme amount of responsibility and empathy, but really understanding consequence as well, and the consequence around it not being intuitive to use? I think the other thing that is really, really important in those scenarios is engaging with your users. So doing that level of user experience testing and usability testing with the people who are actually going to be your final users, allowing them to give you the feedback around what could be done better before they are in that extreme environment where they need to use your product and trust your product.
Oh my word. Yeah, there's actually so much more that goes into it than you think, because the consequences can be dire if you get things wrong, or if people don't understand how to use the product, or if people get confused along the way, or the steps aren't adequately explained or planned out. There's actually so much to think, because it's not just my website's color is purple instead of blue. I mean, a misdiagnosis or a tool not working right, or just a database behind it. There's actually a lot going on there. And I mean, it's I think it's a wonderful testament to like the thought that you put into it. I've seen the product, I've held it in my hand, and I've seen the packaging, and I was like, wow, man, I just want to use it myself. It looks so cool and it can make a massive difference. So well done to you and the Now Boarding team there. And I think this leads well into my next question, which is a design system is very important in the work of app design. It's a thing that holds it all together. It ensures scalability and consistency over time. How do you explain that importance to a client?
John, I think for anybody who has never seen a design system, so, you know, maybe new to the space of building product, maybe sitting in a world of fairly outdated product design. So I would say design systems have really, really come into their own probably over the last 5 years or so, but they've become the de facto standard in product design. If you don't have a good, robust design system, it's probably worth giving it some serious thought. So what a design system does is, if you can imagine a real world scenario. You know, today you've got a designer working on your product, and at some point, inevitably, that designer is going to depart and a new designer is going to come on board. Now, if this product has been in design for, call it, 2 years, how does a new designer come onto the project and fundamentally understand the rules that govern the design of that product? There is a rule book that says this is how forms are created. This is how they look. This is how they feel. This is how buttons behave. These are the patterns that we comply with throughout the app to make sure that things are consistent and creating that end-to-end user experience that feels consistent throughout the app and throughout the experience so that the user is never confused. Now, designer number two comes in and brings their way of thinking in, you can see how things can easily start to fall apart. So a design system is the true north. It is the rule book that governs the design of the app, ultimately. The other thing that a well-built design system allows you to do is, you can imagine products rebrand. Colors change. We need to evolve our UI. If you have got a really, really well-built design system, you can make those changes on a global level and it will quickly roll it out through the entire app. In the old days, you would need to go screen for screen and make all of those app updates. So it's just really important in the world of product that you've got a very well thought through, built and managed design system that you keep up to date in order to govern that consistency, that scalability, and ultimately the continuity of your product design well into the future.
No, excellently. I mean, that makes total sense to me. And talking about designers working on products, when a designer works on a single product for an extended period of time, their enthusiasm can naturally wane. They can get a bit bored. They can get a bit fatigued. Bad design can lead to bad results. And then the company's pulling their hair out because it's just not working anymore. You're a fan of outsourcing product design. Can you tell me a bit more about the benefits of this?
Sure, John. I think, in-source versus outsource is a conversation that we have a lot. It's not one or the other. We've worked in many projects and in many product teams where either it starts with an outsourced model and then migrates to more of an in-house team, or we have worked on projects where there is in-house and we come in to either bring a different level or a different type of expertise to the project, or we ultimately partner with the design team that is sitting internally, again, because we bring a different skill set, or we bring more capacity to the team if they're going through a hump. So there are many different ways to build a product design team. So, John, the key benefits of outsourcing are really we, as any experienced product team would have, but we have a team of people with a huge amount of experience and IP across many, many different industries. So that collective IP allows us to reference many things that we've seen before, allows us to know what has worked in many different or similar situations, environments, and seen a lot of stuff that doesn't work. And we bring all of that IP to the early stages of a product, which can dramatically improve your speed and access to market. So the chances of us getting it right quickly are much higher than employing one in-house designer potentially that is going to sit being dragged around by the development team, by the client, to really, with all of their whims and needs and wants. We can come in as far more of an experienced voice on the project and be able to execute on those early stages a lot faster. The other thing that outsourcing allows you to do is scale your design resources according to the pacing of your project. So any product life cycle goes through humps. There are times where you'll need a little less design because the developers are effectively playing catch up, or you're in a testing cycle. So you put your design and your dev on hold while you are just really iterating and optimizing, and then things kind of slow down a little bit. And then there are phases where you go, oh my goodness, there's this huge market need. A new trend is about to land. We need to be first. Come on, guys, we got to go. And you need to dramatically ramp up your resources. And if you're working with an outsourced team, there's a much better chance that we can pull levers like that. So we can go, okay, cool, we're going to pull more resource onto your project for 3 months, and then we can taper down again. So I think that, outsourcing offers a lot more flexibility in that sort of way as well. But there is a natural point where sometimes it makes a lot of sense to take it internally. And then, coming back to our previous point, if you have built a really good design system from day one, there can be a natural handover into that maintenance phase on your project where you bring somebody in internally and your outsourced team can hand over that design system for that internal designer to potentially run with and then bring you back in again when there's a hump or when, there's a big piece of very strategic work that needs to happen.
Mm. No, 100%, Lee. I'm a big fan of outsourcing. I think you can accelerate your growth a lot faster. You can get stuff done faster. And it's not taken away from the internal designers. I think they can still have a role and they can give a lot of guidance and maybe manage it from a higher level. But the dirty work, the stuff that you need to get done yesterday, outsource that stuff. Have a team of go-to experts that bring that expertise, that bring that insight on what works in other products, what works in other apps. And I think it also can really help you stop getting into this mode where you've done a design and now you think, okay, we're done. We don't have to work on this again for the next 6 months. And you've told me that design work is never really done. It's not a really like a static deliverable. It's like an ongoing part of your product's life cycle. But how does this actually work? How does this work practically? You don't just design something and then hand it off, right?
Absolutely, John. I think anybody who is in the product world will acknowledge that that product is not a sprint. It really is. It's a lifestyle. That's the business that you've chosen. You've chosen to build a tech product that is going to always be in need of ongoing iteration. And again, coming back to that triangle we spoke about earlier, there will always be involvement from technical and from design in all of the ongoing new features that get added because your users are dictating it, new trends that are happening in the industry, like suddenly you want an AI tool, a bot, whatever's trendy and happening, with good reason and very solid business logic, want to bring into your product. There's always going to be a need for technical to be involved and for your user experience designer to be involved in bringing those features to life. But then there's also, to have a successful product, you need to be measuring, you need to be analyzing what's happening on your product, and ultimately you need to be iterating and optimizing on that product in order to reach the goals that you want to over time. So my advice to anybody who would be starting a product from the beginning or building a product team is think about design and technical as key partners on your product journey. And yes, there will be humps and lulls around how much input and effort you need, but ultimately, it's very rare that you can do a ring-fenced project in product and design let's go at that point, because you need somebody who is going to look after your user long-term.
No, 100% agree, Lee. 100% agree. And I really think, again, if you can lay a proper foundation for something like that, you're going to have a good experience dealing with your product, dealing with the threats of AI and the movements in the market. And you can adequately prepare for things like that. And I think oftentimes maybe some clients or business owners think they can ignore this stuff. Okay, this stuff isn't applicable to us. We can still get away with what we did in 1998. Everything's okay. but you need to stay on point. You need to stay current, because people can really people can really just abandon you. They can abandon your app. They can abandon your product. It's like, man, this is so not cool anymore. I can't believe these guys haven't invested in it. It's the same as when you go to someone's website and it says under construction. My word, that is just a buzzkill right there. Hey?
Absolutely, John. I mean, it's user expectations are higher than ever. And that's not just on websites. You know, it's almost, there's a bit of an expectation that websites need to be good. They need to be clear. They need to have really clear conversion funnels. That sort of language and those objectives are really well known to anybody who is trying to design, build, and maintain a website. I think where we really see users being ignored, for lack of a better term, is in the B2B software space. So your users of a VAT solution have no lower expectations than the ones that were visiting your website. Their expectations are higher than ever. And if you're not looking after your user experience of your product and constantly finding ways to keep your users engaged and make sure that they are loving the experience of whatever they're doing, even if it is just VAT compliance, you are really opening yourself up to being disrupted by a competitor. It also, people eat with their eyes and people buy with their eyes. So if your solution doesn't look appealing, there's a high likelihood that they're going to choose a competitor on a superficial level. We have a client at the moment where when they first came to us, they said, our solution is so much more powerful than our competitors, yet we're struggling to land deals. And it's because their solution just didn't look great. So it really is important that we are meeting users' expectations, whether it's in B2B software or on website. We need to understand how high those expectations are these days.
And I also think, like, with the wave of AI that's come out, I mean, users' expectations are on our next level, because they can do so much funky, cool design work themselves, just playing with Midjourney and ChatGPT and Gemini and all these other crazy cool tools that are available. They then expect you to be able to deliver this cool stuff. So how are you managing those expectations? And then how are you and your team actually using AI in the design process?
Awesome, John. You know, I have this question daily, and it feels like every day the answer changes because it is so current and it is so real and so unbelievably exciting, I think. You know, there are two sides to it, or to the question. The one is, how are we using it internally? And from that perspective, we're incredibly excited because these AI tools are coming out that are going to make our lives a lot easier in terms of some of the more monotonous work that we do in our world. So, you know, in every world there are things that you do repeatedly and consistently. And if AI can make us faster at doing those things, or rolling things out logically once the initial thinking has been done, that's incredibly exciting for us. And then we have the ability to spend our time doing the real craft work, doing the things and doing that real interrogation up front. So I try to imagine sometimes a world where our clients are prompting an AI. The biggest challenge, John, is that a lot of the time, the challenge isn't clear yet. So when it comes to us, it would be incredibly difficult for our clients to articulate the challenge that they're having and the solution that they're trying to come up with. So I'm in no way suggesting that AI won't get smarter and smarter at these things over time. You know, we're going to have to live and evolve and roll with it and keep AI as our partner in this game and make sure that we are adapting and being agile. But I think we still have a huge human role in being able to understand the needs and the context and be able to analyze that situation to be able to come up with a solution ultimately. So if AI can help us roll out those solutions faster and still allow us the time to create and do that authentic, unique, beautiful craft that is going to be completely unique to our client, we're excited. The other side of AI, or the other side of the AI story for us, is more and more of our clients are coming to us with AI features and tooling. So they are saying, guys, we want to build in this new AI feature. And our job right now is to figure out how to incorporate this incredibly new technology into interfaces in a way that feels completely intuitive. So it's such an exciting time for us right now, because it feels like we're right there on the edge of innovation again, where there's a whole new tool set coming out that we are busy ideating at the moment how users are going to interact with it. And are the interfaces of current AI tools where they should be? Are they optimized? Is that how AI tools are going to look forever? Absolutely not. So yeah, it's a really, really exciting, interesting time in our world at the moment.
No, that's wonderful, Lee. And I love what you touched on there, which is the human role. So as much as AI takes over the whole world, I think the humans need to step up and own our space as well, and not just give everything away to the robots to sort out, because we know that's the bad end of every movie that has a pop that's focused on the apocalypse. That's the word I wanted to say there. Now, you're talking about the human role at the Right Place podcast. We believe your right place is at the intersection of your roles, relationships, and environments. And you've got a very human role as the MD of Now Boarding, and you told me that you're really enjoying supporting your team and working in the business development space. Tell me how that works on a day-to-day basis and how you almost prepare for that role to step up.
Sure, John. I think, you know, again, over the years, my role has adapted so much over time based on what the business needs from me in any one moment. And I think that agility, adaptability, and change is what really keeps things interesting. But I think that, you know, from my early days as a child, I grew up with, sorry, I've overused this joke, so apologies if you've heard it, but I grew up with software as a sibling. My parents had an IT company, and I grew up at a dinner table where my parents were always talking about tech, but they were running a business that revolved around tech. So even though the product was technology, the core of the conversation was often around people. And it's so interesting how I've ended up in such a similar role. And you really kind of ask yourself, was I always just kind of meant to be this? Was I programmed to be this at an early stage? But I absolutely love the intersection between technology and people. And my role in particular, I don't do any of the actual product design work, but I'm absolutely passionate about what we do. And I have the immense privilege of being able to sit in the business development role where I get to speak to so many different clients across so many different industries doing so many unbelievably interesting things. It blows my mind every day. And really, it's such a privilege to be able to sit and unpack those problems and those needs with clients and help them to see them from a slightly different perspective, to be able to hold that user role and help them to understand how we could shape their business and their product going forward in a more successful, interesting way. But yo, John, the mental agility that I have to do on a daily basis to be able to hop between medtech and insurtech and proptech, just depending on what we're working on in any given moment, it's absolutely fascinating. But we really just, you know, I absolutely believe that we might be the experts in what we do, but our clients are the experts in what they do. And to be able to be in a scenario where you can be so curious and learn so much, it just facilitates so much growth on a personal level in that role. And then I think the other side to the human interaction in the business is the team development and support. So between my business partners and I, we have a team of incredible, incredible human beings, all of whom are very different. But it's beautiful to see how when people come into a nurturing growth mindset environment, one where there is a lot of accountability on the individual, but supported by an amazing team that are always there to push you and catch you, it's beautiful to see how people grow. So yeah, the people aspect of what I do is absolutely key.
No, that's amazing, Lee. And I think that's what keeps life interesting. The people in your business, the relationships that you have, the projects that you work with, the interesting clients that you have, and this agility. I mean, I'm also a big fan of doing a couple of different things, wearing a couple of different hats, because they end up complementing each other. Your focus on business development will give you a whole bunch of insights into what's happening in the market. And then you can help your clients out on the other side, or you can help your staff members, and you can bring new information to the team as well. And not only you come from a corporate background, but now you're working in this small agile team. Is there anything you miss from the corporate days? Oh, and anything that you don't miss?
John, I wouldn't change a thing. I absolutely loved my time in corporate. I was incredibly fortunate to be surrounded by such talented, strategic individuals in the roles that I was working in. And I had such incredible mentors, none of whom ever meant to be a mentor or declared themselves a mentor. But, you know, I could name five of them sitting right here who the lessons that they taught me at every phase of my journey, and many of those were not easy to hear, but they were absolutely critical in the path that I would take thereafter. I think also the skills that I learned in managing people and managing teams come from that environment. You know, being able to manage up, being able to manage down, being able to make everybody feel like they've won at the end of the day. So I thoroughly enjoyed my corporate time. But I did in many ways feel quite stifled by it, particularly in corporate and technology. I think that a lot of the corporate structures that are in place curb innovation. That, again, is my experience. I'm sure it's not the same everywhere. But those corporate structures and that need to climb the ladder create an environment where people need to be right. And needing to be right often means that they're not listening and they're not invested in doing the right thing. And that started to become a little frustrating for me, I think. So making the move to a more small, agile, flexible business environment was absolutely where I found my right place. I didn't know it at the time, but I hadn't come into my own until I found a place where I have the two most incredible business partners. You know, the three of us have worked together for 15 years now, and we still respect, cherish, and love each other as much, if not more, than on day one. And I think the real magic in that is that we have three very complementary skill sets. We are not the same. We are three very, very different human beings, but we are very complementary and we have a huge amount of respect for each other's areas of expertise. We are all very strong-willed, outspoken and opinionated individuals, but the magic is in knowing when to speak, when to listen, and when absolutely to defer. And when it comes to matters of creativity, I am out. I know where my role ends. And even between Jacques and Michelle, my two partners, they overlap a lot more, but they also know when to send designers to speak to each other, and they know who has the final say on certain matters. And that's why it has just worked unbelievably well for us. And I think even with our team, we've got three directors with very different personalities that nurture our team in very different ways. But ultimately, it all works beautifully.
No, that's wonderful. And it's a wonderful testament to knowing what your role is, and then to default into other people who are a better person or a better expert in something, and letting them do them, own their lane, run with it, and you can trust each other. That obviously takes some time. That obviously takes some stepping back sometimes from stuff that you would normally jump into. But I think that's how you build a sustainable business, where you've got the right people doing the right things on a daily basis. And I mean, you already answered my next question. It sounds like you're in your right place in 2025. You're enjoying it a lot. You're enjoying what you're doing. And I mean, that's the perfect place to be in. And yo, whatever happens next with AI or the product space or the UI UX space, I think you've got a robust team around you. And one of the things that you've done, which I'm really excited about, is that you joined the Lacquer Network pretty much from the beginning, I think. Tell me why you joined and what has been your experience so far.
Oh, John, I am one of the biggest South Africa advocates that you'll find. You know, I will be the last to leave. it's really, I love South Africa. I love our people and I love our nature and our spirit and what we are able to achieve when we get together. And I think I knew Nick from previous mentoring experiences. I think we were both mentors on a similar program, and we were aware of each other. And I obviously followed him on LinkedIn, as you do. And when he started talking about the Liquor Network, I just knew that we had to be part of it. I think on a personal level, it spoke deeply to things that are very meaningful to me. But even from a business perspective, we just had to be part of this network that was going to connect South Africans globally, because we are a force of nature when we are together. And if we can build these bridges together and facilitate and open opportunities for each other, then, you know, we stuck our hand up right away. We were one of the founding members, and it has been absolutely remarkable being part of this experience and seeing how the network is growing and flourishing and the opportunities that are coming out of it.
No, that's wonderful, Lee. I mean, that's such a perfect and succinct answer, where you understood the spirit right from the get-go, and that you want to contribute, you want to add value, you want to answer the question, how can I help? And I keep telling people, it's not a sales network. It's a learning network. It's learning from other South Africans who have gone ahead of you, who are in another country doing the same thing as you or having the same challenges, and how we can support each other. And we've got that commonality. We are South African. We love our country. We want to help each other. And if one person succeeds, we are happy for them. And our time at the top will come. Our moment to shine will come. But it's definitely a thing of adding value, showing up, being happy for other people. And the right things are going to come your way, because the people that are in the Lacquer Network really, really want to be in the Lacquer Network.
John, the word that keeps coming up for me around the Lacquer Network is, it is by far the most intentional network I've ever been part of. People know why they're there. It is so clear. And how that founding team or the management team have created such a common vision, focus, and goal is what keeps us all aligned. It's what makes us know why we're there, why we exist, and it's what keeps us all sticking out a hand. If anybody reaches out and says, can I have a chat? The answer is absolutely yes, because it's, how can I help you? That's why I'm here. But everybody's intention is there, and it feels like any hand that I stick up and that I have put up over the last couple of months, people flock to your aid. It's quite overwhelming sometimes. If you're looking for a resource or a supplier, you get inundated with help requests, referrals. But also if you just need a little bit of advice from somebody who has been there before, you know, I've seen conversations happening on the WhatsApp group where I can see a level of expertise that I just need to ask for help. So I don't have to do it publicly, but I have reached out privately before and gone, I saw that conversation. This is a challenge that I'm currently having. Do you have 5 minutes for me? And it's, nobody has even remotely shied away from reaching out and helping out.
No, that's wonderful. And the thing is, all those little moments add up. They all add up in terms of helping each other, being visible, showing up, and the wheel will turn in your favor. It's just how the universe works. And I've seen it in my own life and in my own work with the Lacquer Network so far. So thank you, Lee. That's a really wonderful testimony about the beauty of the Lacquer Network. Now, Lee, it's been really great talking to you today. I wish we could go on much longer. If people want to connect with you, if they want to learn more about Now Boarding, where's the best place to do that?
Well, the easy one, our website is nowboarding.io. Otherwise, absolutely welcome to connect with me on LinkedIn. I am very present and available and always keen to chat.
Excellent, Lee. Ladies and gentlemen, please connect with Lee. Remember to follow and subscribe to the Right Place podcast. Lee, thank you so much for your time. It's been a great conversation, as I expected. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next time at the Right Place. Cheers.